Hey everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to the January 2020 feature interview. And I am so happy we got to sit down with Ben Patterson, who is originally from Philly, went to school here in Chicago, lived here for a number of years, did a heck of a lot of playing around town. He's in town this weekend, so we're catching up with him while he's in town. And then he's also now living in New York, playing all over the world, and we're going to hear all about that. So, Ben, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Nice to be here.
I'm glad we caught up with you because, you know, we've talked about doing different things over the years, and, I mean, you're releasing different releases. Now, this is coming out in January, but he just came out with a holiday CD that was launched in December. So we'll do a separate preview for that so that we drop that in December. But you're in town, you're playing at Winters, but, you know, before we get into everything else, you've got all these shows coming up. You're now a Steinway artist. Congratulations.
Yep, thank you very much.
Why don't we start with that? Let's talk a little bit about that. That's pretty exciting.
I've got a good friend over at Steinway who's been an artist there for a long time. She's a stride pianist named Judy Carmichael. And we've become friends over the years. She actually has her own podcast and radio show called Jazz Inspired, which you should check out if you haven't heard of it. She interviews people like Robert Redford, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Tony Bennett, and talks to them about their sort of intersections with jazz. But anyway, she'd been kind of recommending me to the Steinway folks for years. And then last year I won this competition, this Ellis Marsalis jazz piano competition. And I think after that, the Steinway people kind of took notice and we got to talking, and it took a little while to make it happen. But as of a few months ago, I'm officially a Steinway artist.
Well, that's impressive, right?
Yeah. I mean, it feels good. They are, I can say, you know, without any hesitation, that's my favorite brand of piano. So yeah. I'm really happy to be associated with it.
Congratulations. And, you know, we should talk a little bit. I mean, you know, you play piano, obviously. Now you play Steinway pianos. Mm-hmm. But you also play organ, B3 organ, and you came up in Philly. Mm-hmm. So growing up in Philly, there's so many organ players that come out of Philadelphia. What is in the water in Philadelphia?
I don't know. It's a little crazy, but yeah, all the, you know, 90% of the great organ players all come out of Philly. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Though I have to confess, I didn't start playing organ until I was here in Chicago.
Okay.
So when I was in Philly, yeah, going up, there were a couple clubs. There was a place called Ortlieb's, which did have Shirley Scott would play there from time to time, so I did get to hear her once or twice. Mickey Roker, the great drummer, used to play there all the time. And they had a jam session, so my first couple jam session experiences were going to Ortlieb's and completely getting my butt kicked. But I didn't play that much when I was in Philly. It was more after moving to Chicago for college that I started going out to jam sessions and really kind of getting my feet
wet. Did you start playing piano at a young age?
I did piano, classical piano, starting around 6 years old. So I had about 11 years of classical piano by the time I got out of high school.
Yeah.
And I started mixing in jazz probably around age 13 or 14, discovering folks like Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson and Ahmad Jamal. And I said, that looks like fun. I want to do that.
So, I mean, were your parents musical?
Yeah, they both actually perform in amateur theater, community theater around Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
And so they would sing in musicals from time to time. And the first jazz experience I had was trying to pick out chord charts, backing them up as they rehearsed for these songs, for these old musicals, these community theater stuff.
That's amazing to me. So were you, like, you started playing piano, you were obviously drawn to the piano, and you started taking lessons, but your parents didn't really play piano.
Yeah, not really. Not too much.
I mean, the reason why I'm bringing it up is because usually there's somebody in the family or somebody's playing piano or playing drums or something like that. So you were pretty inspired at a young age then.
Yeah, I think, my dad always had classical music going on in the house and then hearing them do those musicals. And then I should give some credit to my older brother, John, who also dabbled in jazz piano for a bit. So I probably, you know, started it in attempt to trying to be like him. He did it for about a year or so and then moved on to other things. But for me, it stuck for whatever reason.
Yeah. So playing, I mean, the whole usual stuff, you're playing in high school, playing piano in the jazz bands and things like that. I mean, back then, you're serious about it at that point? Or you're just kind of like, well, here's the music, I'll play this, and then I'm screwing around after school and it is what
it is. It's hard to know, you know, later on. But looking back, actually, as a junior in high school, they had us do these projects called a junior year experience project. And they gave you a month off of, or I can't remember if it was 2 weeks or a month, but they gave you some time off of school. And essentially you were supposed to go out into the real world and either sort of intern somewhere or teach something or volunteer. You were supposed to do some kind of thing in the real world.
Yeah.
And I remember I went to my jazz teacher who I'd kind of just started with. And I said, you know, how do you make this work as a living? And where do you play and how do you find gigs? And so for that month or whatever it was, I basically tried my best to live the life of a gigging jazz pianist. And I managed to book, I don't know, 3 or 4 gigs. And,
wow.
And I did a lot of practicing and I maybe made my first version of a website or something. So looking back on it, I think even by junior year of high school, I had a good idea that that's kind of what I wanted to do.
Wow. All right. So, but if you're playing gigs and you're doing that stuff, I mean, you're learning tunes, obviously, right? I mean, so I remember going to the Jamie Abersole camps,
mm-hmm.
and he had a specific way of learning tunes. This is something I always love to ask, like, accomplished players, right? Is, like, do you have – well, back then, were you learning tunes? Like, did you – were you even – you're probably memorizing some, but did you have a system to start getting into learning tunes? If you're trying to get gigs at that point, you obviously
yeah.
probably heard from your teacher that, well, you know, you gotta know tunes, you got to be able to do this, do that,
yeah.
all that stuff. I mean, were you consciously starting to learn standards back then?
I was getting there. I think from backing up my parents as they sang this stuff, I would hear some of the songs from those old
yeah,
musicals,
right,
like
tunes
If I Were a Bell from Guys and Dolls, or, you know.
Story with a Fringe on Top.
Yeah. So I learned some tunes that way. And then at the time, like I said, I was getting into Oscar Peterson and Ahmad Jamal and stuff. So I would try to figure out what they were playing. And so I was learning some tunes that way. Most of the gigs I did during that period were just solo piano, or I was backing up a singer.
Mm-hmm.
So I would kind of get the tunes from the singer, or I would just kind of play whatever I knew. I wasn't yet at the point where you could just kind of throw me up with a bunch of musicians and we'd just be calling tunes. You know, I had to kind of have some idea of what was going on before I got in.
Do you have, just kind of, you know, moving forward even now, I mean, if you want to talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that since we're talking about this, because I think it's important. I think that a lot of musicians, especially the musicians that get out of college, and they can play, they can do everything, but they just don't have that repertoire behind them where
right.
you can go do stuff. And now, you know, obviously with the advent of the iPad, maybe
right.
they can do that. But, I mean, that's not a good system to begin with, I don't
right.
think. It's my personal opinion. But did you have, like, a system of, like, saying, okay, I'm going to learn all of the, you know, all of the Rodgers and Hammerstein tunes, or
right.
all of this, or
right.
all the Gershwin, and so, I mean, just start delving into that.
I didn't go about it in such a premeditated way as that, but I would say, I think from the beginning, I've always worked with a lot of singers. That's kind of been, you know, sort of my,
I think that's
from,
really
from the early part
too,
of my career.
Right?
I think it's super important.
Yeah.
You learn a lot about phrasing, you learn a lot about touch on the piano, and you learn about transposing. And that is, if especially as a pianist, if you really want to learn a tune, if you take a new song and you transpose it through all 12 keys, the changes, the voicings, the melody, by the time you get through all those 12 keys, that tune is stuck in your head forever. So that's, I think, sort of my best advice for learning tunes is do that transposition.
How long
stuff.
Did it take you when you first started?
Oh, forever.
Like, forever, right? To do all 12 keys, yeah. like just on any Autumn Leaves. I mean,
yeah.
it had to be like...
Yeah.
A week, maybe?
Yeah, to get it through all 12 keys, in the beginning it might have taken me a week. But it's really, I tell students all the time to do it, because it's like a musical full-body workout, because it's working everything. It's your voicings, your ear, your harmonies, your sense of melody, your ability to you know, really use your ear and transpose. And then the other thing that did it for me, and this was, you know, you're mentioning the new apps and everything,
right.
how you can have a chart wherever you go. So my first few years playing in Chicago, I did have a real book. And then I think my backpack got stolen at a certain point and I didn't have it anymore. And I was forced to just start using my ear.
Yeah.
And that was maybe one of the best things that could happen to me, because suddenly I started hearing everything in much more detail, really being able to pick up changes from the bass player. And the other thing that forced me to do that was I started playing with Vaughn Freeman. And Vaughn, we never had a sheet of music on stage. And even in front of, you know, concert crowds at the Green Mill or Symphony Center or whatever, he would just start playing a tune without telling us what the name of the tune was or what key we were in. And so you had to just hear it or you were in trouble. That was
right.
the way it went.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he had Matt Ferguson was his bass player at the time. And Matt had been playing with him for 6 or 7 years at that point. So Matt knew all the tunes. So all I had to do was really just be able to pick up those changes by ear from Matt on the bass. And that's, you know, that's really the way to learn to use your ears. You gotta, that's just how you got
to
do it.
Well, I not to stay on the point too long, but I think that also, I mean, when you start doing that, you get out of looking at like your iPad, mm-hmm. looking at a real book.
Right.
You start to hear the 251s. I mean, there's only so many formulas for the most part in, 90% of the tunes that jazz standard set
right.
is.
That's right.
But if you can't hear them without looking at them, it's a different ballgame. But the minute you can start hearing them, yeah. how does that all of a sudden open up your improvisational skills? I mean, that's got to just be like, oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, it just puts you it puts you in direct contact with the music. There's no more barrier. And I have a student I was teaching just a couple weeks ago who's a middle-aged guy who used to play when he was young. He's getting back into it. And he has these tunes he's been playing for years. But every time he plays them, he still puts the music up. And I said, okay, let's just try something. I said, look, we're going to take the music away. And he got all nervous about it. And I said, well, let's just see what happens, you know. And his playing immediately got so much better because he was directly connecting with the instrument and his ears were directly connecting with the music. Even though it was a tune that he knew 100% and had played 1,000 times, the music was still this extra step between him and the actual sound of the music itself. And by taking it away, that was the easiest lesson I ever taught, because all I had to do was take this thing away and he immediately sounded better.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I think that's something that a lot of people, especially this day and age, overlook. But it's so important. And it's amazing how many tunes you actually know mm-hmm. when you're not looking at them.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, so you're playing piano. Now you're gigging in Philadelphia.
A little bit, yeah.
You're making millions. So you get out of high school and you decide that you want to go to college.
Yep.
And did you come to Chicago for college? Like, this is where you got your bachelor's? This is where you came to school? Why did you decide to come to Chicago? I mean, you're in Philadelphia, man. There's a lot of other options, especially for music, if you wanted to go there.
Well,
right?
So I wasn't, you know, I went to a good high school in Philadelphia, Quaker school called Germantown Friends School. And it's a good school. They send most of their graduates off to good universities. And my parents, you know, they knew I was serious about music, but I didn't 100% know that that was really what I wanted to do. I had an idea. And, you know, they sort of said, well, you got into this great school, University of Chicago. Why don't you go and see if you find something that you like even better than
music? What'd you get in on? I mean, just like academics you got into?
Yeah. The music stuff helped, I'm sure. Yeah. But it wasn't – U of C isn't really a music-focused school.
Right.
They're good in composition and ethnomusicology, but they're not really a performance-based school. Mm-hmm. But it's academically one of the best. So – I went, and I had a great time. I met a lot of great people, but after about 2 years of doing their core curriculum and studying all this other stuff, I said, I think music is still on the top of my list.
So you didn't pick a major at that point. You're kind of going through stuff.
Well, I ended up picking political science, which was super interesting, and learned a lot. But music was – by my junior year of college, I was sneaking out to go to jam sessions around the South Side. I would go to Jimmy's Woodlawn Tap.
Oh, yeah.
They had a jam session the first Friday of every month at this place called the Quadrangle Club at the University of Chicago.
That's right.
There was – and then there were a bunch of these South Side spots, like the City Life that June Yvonne would run. The New Apartment Lounge with Von Freeman. Mm-hmm. So I started sneaking out to those jam sessions. And that was really my early Chicago musical experience.
Well, in those places, I mean, I think that's like one of those places that if you're on the north side, usually, especially your age, you would never get down to.
Right.
So to be exposed to that first, and then maybe go to Andy's or maybe go to the Mill or whatever, it's a different thing. Now you're looking at it completely different. Now you're really getting the full scope of the Chicago jazz scene.
Yeah, and I feel very fortunate to have come up with that. I did eventually, of course, find Andy's and the Mill. And,
sure.
But, you know, early on it was all Southside stuff. And I remember when I first got called to be in the house band for the Velvet Lounge Sunday night jam, you know, I was like, man, I made it. I said, this is as far as I need to go in my career. I'm the house pianist at the Velvet.
Was that the old one or the new one?
Yeah, the old one, Indiana, okay. With the barbecue spot right next door. And it was me with Dennis Winslet was running it.
I remember Dennis.
And on bass, it was either Junius Paul or there was a bassist, Yosef Kim, who was around for a while. And the drummer was either Andre Beasley or Isaiah Spencer would do it sometimes. And so I got that Velvet, that was kind of my original crew, you know.
Wow.
Even though they were playing way more kind of modern stuff than I had ever played before. And I felt kind of, I said, well, I'm really, you know, I've grown up basically doing Oscar Peterson and Modern Jamal, and now I'm here at the Velvet with these guys playing some pretty avant-garde stuff. So that was a good education for me, too.
Yeah, well, and of course, it gets back to your ears are wide open at that point, because that's something that I always talk about, like when I had Dee Alexander in, and we were talking about the AACM. I mean, you know, she's coming from a straight-ahead thing, and then all of a sudden, it just opens up your whole thought process, I think, just to think about things differently and get different concepts happening, you know.
Well, the other thing I'll add to that, too, is the one thing I did do jazz-related at the University of Chicago was I was in the Jazz Extet, which is the UFC Jazz Ensemble, which is led by Mwata Bowden.
Okay.
And he actually just called me the other day. They're having their 25th anniversary this coming year, and so he's probably going to do some kind of reunion band concert or something.
Oh, cool.
But Mwata structured it super well, where at UFC you do, it's not semesters, you do three, they do a quarter system there. So summer is one quarter, and then you have three other periods throughout the year. And so the first quarter, we would do old traditional stuff. We did Count Basie and Thad Jones and, you know, classic charts.
Yeah.
Then the second quarter, we would get a little bit more modern. And then by the spring quarter, we were doing Henry Threadgill and Wadada Leo Smith and AACM and charts that were, you know, triangles with an arrow pointing to a circle and all that stuff. And for me, it was mind-blowing because I'd never been exposed to or played anything like that in my life. And there was one spot in the concert I remember where the whole band cut out, and Fred Anderson was the special guest for that concert. And it was just this block that just said open improvisation, piano, and sax. So it was just me and Fred Anderson with a completely open, unstructured section of improvisation.
Doing whatever.
And I was absolutely terrified by it. And I went to him and I said, oh, Fred, you know, if you have any, Mr. Anderson, if you have any tips for me, you know, please let me know. I don't really do a lot of this kind of stuff. So, you know, if you have any suggestions, let me know. Yeah. And he just said, oh, use your ears, you'll be fine. And that was all he gave me. And it was cool. It was so Mwata exposed me to, you know, opened up my ears and had me doing some different stuff, too.
You know, with all the playing you do now and, you know, in New York, you're meeting tons of musicians, you're traveling, doing all that. How many of those musicians, and I think you do a lot, you know, primarily straight ahead stuff or contemporary straight ahead stuff. How many of those musicians would even understand what you're talking about when you're talking about that? I mean, because they were probably never exposed to that. They'd be looking at that like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, well, the Chicago sort of avant-garde scene or free scene does have its own character and its own history. And I'm not 100% sure how much New York sort of connects with that. They probably do more than I know of. But since I'm not really on that scene in New York, I don't really know how much overlap there is there.
Yeah.
The thing about New York is there's so many good musicians around that people tend to specialize and get very much sort of into their niche scene. Like if you want to play stuff from music from 1928 to 1933, you can find a whole scene of really good musicians that are into that exact specific type of thing. And if you want to play, you know, Kenny Garrett kind of stuff, you can find people that are super into that. If you want to play whatever kind of style of jazz you're into, you can find a whole crew of other music, really top-notch players who are into that exact specific genre.
Is there an audience for that in New York? I mean,
amazingly there is. It's you have clubs, you know, like Smalls and Mesro and Smoke, and I mean, there's just a lot of venues. And then musicians create their own venues. And, you know, I would say New York is great because you have a lot of clubs with an audience, and the audience will be younger, too. It's, I'd say, more so than other cities, it really gets a younger jazz crowd.
Yeah. You know, the thing that and I'm jumping around because we're talking about this, but the thing with New York that I find, since you brought up the audience thing, it almost reminds me of, like, Chicago with the rock scene back in the, and you wouldn't remember this, but back in the, like, late 80s, early 90s when, like, the Smashing Pumpkins were coming up and people would go to a specific venue like Elbow Room or Metro because they didn't know what this band or any of these bands were at that point because they were coming up like Filter or whatever. But they knew it was that venue was going to have that music in and it was going to be smoking and you wanted to check it out. And to me, every time I'm in New York, you're right. It's like, I know if I go to Smalls, right. Or if I go to even 55 Bar or something, I know what I'm going to hear. I don't know necessarily if I know all the musicians there, but it's going to be something pretty hip happening.
Yeah, you know sort of generally what the style is, and you know that it's going to be a high-level musicianship.
Yeah. So you're going to school, and then you decided to start studying music. Did you Did you leave University of Chicago at that point?
No, I finished my degree.
So you got it.
I graduated 2004, political science.
Well, which helps with music because there's political.
There's a lot of political. Yeah, exactly. yeah, it was. So, but then I kind of said, okay, well, but I got my degree. I took care of my responsibilities. Now let me just kind of launch myself into this and see if being a working jazz musician, like, let me see what that is. Let me see what that's really like. And so I found a cheap apartment with a few roommates in Hyde Park. I somehow found a room for $160 a month, which I still can't believe was possible. I mean, I had three other roommates, and I was basically living in like a pantry off the kitchen, which is kind of ridiculous. But it was cool for me, and it was, I had my car, and I could basically, you know, if I played one gig or two gigs a month, I could basically pay my rent. So I just started going out to every jam session I could find.
Were you able to practice in the place?
I had a keyboard. I didn't have a piano, but I had a keyboard I was practicing on. And, things started to pick up. Again, I think because I had worked with singers already for a while, I was able to kind of slide right into working with a bunch of singers, guys like Paul Marinaro. Who were the other singers I used to work with back then?
Did you do anything with, like, Elaine?
With Elaine. Like, I remember doing
Dame,
with her.
Dame, I should say.
I mean, yeah, pretty probably, you know, any Chicago vocalist you could name, I've worked with at some point.
I think you were at Caterina's was around then too, right? And that was kind of like a hotbed of singers up there.
I would play there from time to time, definitely at Andy's. And then around 2006 was when Vaughn Freeman picked me up for his band. But actually, before Vaughn added me to his band, he had me try out with his brother George. And that was my first ever organ gig, was playing organ with George Freeman at this club called the Tropical Den on 71st and Exchange. And I played there every Thursday with George for about 6 months.
No kidding.
Because Vaughn had heard me sitting in at the new apartment lounge, and if there wasn't a bass player to play the jam, I would split my keyboard with a bass sound and I would walk bass on the lower end of the keyboard.
Were you practicing that at that point, or...? Just
I'd always kind of done that. I always kind of wanted that bass line groove. And I was getting hired for gigs where if they didn't want to hire a bassist, I would
just do that. Sure.
So Vaughn heard me do that at the jam, and then he kind of said, you know, my brother George could use you. So they sent me over to the Tropical Den, and it was me and George Freeman and a drummer named Joe Jenkins. And we played there every Thursday from 8 to midnight. And that was my first ever organ gig.
That was Maurice, right? Was that Maurice Jenkins or no?
Oh, could have been. Yeah. I don't actually know.
Yeah. Drummer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So you were learning with a split keyboard at that point.
Yeah.
You weren't playing with pedals or anything like that.
And then I didn't really start.
That's a different kind of vibe, though, like a different kind of grooving
right.
when you've got a drummer and George and you're holding the whole thing down.
Yeah.
Like for an entire gig, right?
Yeah.
Rather than just sitting in for a couple of tunes.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Was that something that you had to then go and practice? Because, I mean, to get that feel happening?
It took, I was practicing that and then doing some gigs on there. And then once I started getting more serious about playing organ, I started studying with Chris Foreman.
Okay.
And Chris was really my organ teacher. I mean, he showed me how to turn the thing on. Because I don't know if you know, but on B3, there's two on switches, and you have to start, there's like a starter motor.
You have to hold
them for a certain number of seconds. And so Chris taught me all that. And then he taught me drawbar settings and all this Jimmy McGriff tunes and language. And so Chris was a big influence. And especially on organ, I would say he's my biggest influence for the Hammond B3 for sure.
Wow.
Chris, and he's still one of my favorite living organ player. I mean, every time I go hear Chris, I get a big smile on my face.
Yeah. Well, I mean that guy, that feel that he has is like ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And it would be wild to be doing gigs, and he would come and sit in on the gig. He'd be playing the exact same organ with the same band and the same sound, but somehow he would sit down at that thing and like immediately the whole club would elevate and just turn into a party. And I said, man, how are you doing that? You know? But like that's how you learn, is by, you know, doing it and then seeing somebody like Chris get up on the same gear in the same spot and like what is he doing differently that's creating this feeling. And
then,
you know, he's the best at that.
Yeah. Well, and talking a little bit about organ now, I mean, you know, you're playing piano, you're backing up singers, and then all of a sudden, if they know you can play and kick left-handed bass.
Right.
You know, your stock just went up even more, I'm sure, because now it's like, oh, man, call Ben, man. Yeah. We don't have to have a bass player. This is going to be great. Now we can play all these different places. I also think that when you're playing with singers, we touched on it a little bit, but, you know, talking about it, you as a musician, when you're playing with singers, you learn a lot of tunes, a lot of, like, B-side tunes that, you know, no instrumentalist is ever going to call, but you're learning them because the vocalists are playing
them. Right.
And I think that's such a huge help in just learning the repertoire.
Absolutely.
And now you're learning it while you're kicking left-handed bass.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, and transposing at the same time. So that was an extra challenge.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you don't even have a bass player to lean on, you really got to be able to transpose that
tune.
Better
know the tune.
Yeah. Organ, playing organ, you don't get a lot of help. You pretty much got to be able to do it.
So do you like playing one or the other, like piano or organ, or it's just like you either one?
You know, I love them both. I mean, I've played piano since I was six, so I probably have technique-wise and just in terms of command of the instrument, I probably have a little bit of a piano, have a little more time on the piano.
Yeah.
You know, organ-wise, you know, someone like Joey DeFrancesco, who grew up playing the organ since he was four or five, yeah, right. He can do all kinds of stuff on the organ that I'm just not really doing. But
he can play trumpet, too, while he plays
I know. He can just do all kinds of stuff. But I definitely had a period of, you know, 4 or 5 years where I was playing organ gigs 3 nights a week. And I've put in a lot of time on the organ. I've learned a lot of the language. And even Joey, actually, he heard me playing in New York not too long ago. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, man, good for you. He said, you've got all this old Jimmy McGriff and Jimmy Smith, this classic kind of blues, soul-drenched organ jazz vocabulary. And he said, don't ever lose that because a lot of organists try to skip all that and go right to all the modern stuff.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's Chris that really taught me to do that.
Yeah.
And I spent years playing with Guy King, a great guitar player
sure,
and
yeah,
singer.
Sure, yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
So, you know, playing organ in his band, we did a lot of Wes Montgomery and Kenny Burrell, but then we also do a lot of Ray Charles. We do a lot of
Stevie, you know, Wonder.
Stevie Wonder. Yeah. So that kind of gets you to really bring in that kind of soul book vocabulary.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, you while you were in Chicago, I mean, you brought up Guy. I mean, you were playing steady with Guy at Andy's, and then
yeah.
he started traveling and touring and stuff. You were doing the Von Freeman thing. Then you started playing with Bobby Broom.
That was much later, though.
Oh, was
it? I didn't actually play. I hadn't played a gig with Bobby until he called me in 2014 to go on the road for 3 months opening for Steely Dan.
Oh, you hadn't played?
We had never played a gig before.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Were you in town still? You were in
I
New
was
York.
Not.
You just, that because didn't you just get to New York and then Bobby calls you and then you're out on the road for like three
well,
months?
Well, I moved to New York in 2013, April okay. of 2013. Yeah. And this was, I think, May of 2014, May or June. And I actually happened to be back in Chicago. So Bobby got called by Steely Dan to put together a group. And he was yeah. going to bring his guitar trio with Dennis Carroll on bass and Mackay on drums. And then at the last minute, Steely Dan said, no, it has to be an organ trio. And Bobby was ready to kind of be like, okay, well, then I don't have a band for you. Because he didn't have an organ trio at
right.
that time. Deep Blue wasn't working together anymore. And Micaiah kind of said, hey, you know, why don't we just think about who we could maybe get
yeah,
on organ?
Like,
before we say no to this, let's just see who we could get. And they kind of ran down some names, and my name came up, and Bobby had heard me playing with Guy, and had maybe sat in for a tune, but I mean, maybe I'd sat in with Deep Blue like once
yeah.
or twice. But Bobby in his head, he said, you know, something about it seemed like it could possibly work, and I happened to be in Chicago at the time. I was back here just doing a couple weeks of gigs.
Yeah.
So we got together for a rehearsal, and you know, Bobby said, "Can you block out these 3 months?" I said, "To go open for Celia Dan, yeah, I'll block out
yeah,
3 months."
So
and so then we went and did that, and that was the beginning of that band, Bobby Broom Organization.
Yeah.
And since then, we've played in Beijing, in Paris, or in France, and we just did 10 days at the Umbria Jazz Fest in Italy a couple months ago. And we got our record out. So it's been really great. That led
yeah.
to a really cool project.
Well, I think actually at the time of this recording in December, you guys are about to go back out and do a couple of dates out of the East
Coast.
That's
right. We're playing
too,
at Scullers in Boston and a cool club called The Side Door in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got a couple.
Is it Kobe playing
mm-hmm.
drums?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a good band.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Those are not shabby musicians,
no.
That's for sure.
So you're playing all over town, doing all this stuff. Why did you decide, because you're super busy in Chicago, I mean, you know, you started off living in a pantry,
yep.
and now you have enough money maybe to have 2 bedrooms.
Yep, yep.
So you decide to move to New York,
right?
Where you probably are somewhat have some connections, but you're not walking in there like tons of gigs.
Yeah, so no, I moved there with 0 gigs.
Starting brand new again there. Yeah. What was the inspiration to take it over there?
Well, I'd been going there a couple times a year just, you know, for a few years to check it out. Starting around 2010 or so, I would go there for a couple weeks every year. And, I mean, I could see how much was happening there and how inspirational it was. I could also see how difficult it was. I heard a lot of stories from people who had moved there. And done well or not done well, but, you know, even the ones who did well were saying how tough it was. Yeah. Clark Summers was one, actually, because he had, was living in New York at the time, and I used to see him every time I went and kind of check in and be like, how's it going? You know? And then, I don't know, the timing just kind of worked. I mean, so Vaughn passed away in 2012. So that was one kind of major thing that I, mm-hmm. was the reason that was keeping me here that went away. Guy King, who I was playing with a ton, he actually ended up leaving town for a while and moving to Brazil.
That's
for
right.
a bit.
Yeah.
So that was another source of gigs that went. And I don't know, I just kind of, you know, with whatever was going on in my life at the time, I said, you know, now's kind of the time to do this. If I don't do it now, I was 30 years old. And I, you know, I knew basically when you move to New York, you have to dive back into, I had no gigs. So I didn't move back into a pantry, but I did move back into a small room in an apartment I was sharing with three other people. And, you know, basically had to start over going to every jam session I could find every night for a year, you know, just meeting people, playing, introducing myself, trying to get going.
Yeah.
And I had a few contacts of people who had moved there and people I'd gotten to know a bit, but I definitely had no gigs on the books when I moved there.
It's so hard to now. I had Chico Freeman, talk about Vaughn Freeman, Chico Freeman, Vaughn's son, three issues ago, whenever it was. I think it was in October. And he talks about when he moved to New York, he like accidentally moved to New York. He like was flying in, stopped there. And then knew one guy from Chicago, went and sat in, and all of a sudden he got like a gig.
Right.
And then he got another gig. Then he's got all these gigs and everything else. He's talking all about it and everything. But it was still difficult. But these days,
right?
I mean, it's not like that, man. There's so much competition there and so little work, I think. I mean, is that what you found?
Yeah, I would say when people ask me to compare Chicago to New York, I say – it's, you know, there's a lot of complicated points of comparison.
Sure, yeah.
But, and the overarching thing of it, I'd say New York has about 10 times as many venues and about 50 times as many musicians. So there's a lot of opportunity, there's a lot of places to play, but there's also a crazy amount of competition. And especially, you know, there's a lot of music schools there and good ones, Juilliard and Manhattan and New School, and they're putting out very good musicians every year that are just adding to the scene.
Yeah.
The other thing about New York, everybody moves there from overseas. So all the best jazz players from Japan, from Italy, from Spain, from France, from Sweden, if they, you know, they're all trying their best to move to New York. And so they come for however long they can get a visa or if they come to school or whatever it is. So it's a very kind of international scene. But that ended up really working to my advantage because by being there, you meet all these people from all over the world. And so I got to play with these musicians, and now they've moved home. I now know musicians in Italy and in Singapore and in Sweden. And so if I'm going through Europe or I'm coming through Asia, I can kind of call them up and say, hey, I'm coming through your part of the world. And they'll go to their local venues and they'll say, hey, I got this buddy of mine coming from New York. And anywhere you are overseas, if they see someone coming from New York, they're like, boom, we gotta book them.
Yeah.
So now it's sort of like through having gotten to know this international jazz community, I'm able to set up these tours by using these musicians who are buddies as sort of these local agents in different spots. And so that's kind of one of the main advantages of New York is just that internationalness.
All part of your master plan.
A little bit.
Now I see it.
Now, you know, a lot of those tours, especially in the beginning, were crashing on couches
barely
coming home with any dough at all.
Right.
But after doing that for a few years, it's really grown into some bigger opportunities.
So you also started singing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how much you were singing in Chicago, because I don't remember you really singing at all in Chicago, at least not publicly. But now you're singing, you're playing. Mm-hmm. So now you're playing organ. And you're singing. I've always contended, you know, I mean, first of all, I play drum set, so nobody wants to hear me sing. But nobody wants to hear me play organ either. But, you know, I've always contended if you're a piano player and you can sing,
right.
or an organ player who can sing, you just, like, tripled the amount of places you could potentially be working.
Yeah.
And whether it's solo, duo, whatever you want to do, because you're the entertainment at that point, and you're singing.
Well, that was,
is that one of your motivations?
That was part of the motivation. Yeah. I don't usually sing when I'm playing organ just because that's a lot to have going on at the same time, kind of like playing drums and singing.
Right.
But I do it from time to time, but mostly on piano. So partly that. I mean, it opens up certain doors. Partly just from working with singers for all these years, I know a ton of tunes and a ton of lyrics, so I already know all these tunes. And then the guy that really inspired me to do it, and who also is one of the reasons I moved to New York, actually, is this great pianist, Johnny O'Neill, who I know has been coming out here and playing
at Winters. Coming. Yeah, playing at Winters, yeah.
And he was, when I used to go to visit New York before I moved there, I would go see him play, And I said, man, this guy is just playing everything that I want to play. He's got this incredible swing. He's playing all this blues, all these insane harmonies. He's digging out these obscure old ballads and tunes that nobody ever does anymore that are just these beautiful, heartbreaking songs. And so I said, you know, that's, I would love to do something like that, to watch the ability that he has to really command an audience, both with his playing and with the, you know, just even if you just sing two or three songs a set, the difference it makes in terms of really holding an audience and telling a story is like night and day.
Yeah.
So it's been fun. So I've been mixing it in more and more each gig.
Did you take vocal lessons so you could breathe from your diaphragm and all?
Yeah, I've been taking not a ton, but I probably take maybe a vocal lesson a month or something like that.
Yeah.
And again, I started very slow, and now I'm kind of sneaking it in. But these days, every show I do, if it's my own gig, my own name, I'm always singing at least a few songs.
You know, that's the thing too that and you can talk to this, because I think that if you're playing piano, you know, and I mean, I've played with you every once in a great while, but I mean, the pocket's there, man. It starts grooving, and it could go for 10 minutes grooving. So as a vocalist, your phrasings, how easy is it to move the phrasing from the piano to your vocal, right?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's something that's still kind of developing. But I realized I was kind of doing the vocal thing for a while, and then I realized that because vocals was a new thing for me and because it's so exposed in front of the audience, when I was going in to sing, I was really kind of zeroing in, and I was losing all my awareness of the rest of the rhythm section. So what I had to kind of relearn was to be able to sing while making sure to have that whole band awareness.
Ah.
And as soon as I did that, then the phrasing started to fall into place and started to get better and better. So I think that's, you know, for musicians or for singers, you know, really trying to be able to do your thing while listening as close as you can to the rest of the band is, you know, of the highest importance. And that's really how you get that phrasing, how you get that feel, is by not just focusing on what you're doing, but hearing how it relates to the rest of the group.
And you know, I know from playing drums, the hardest part was being able to split your ears while you're concentrating on what's going on, right?
Right.
You have to do the same thing, listening to the bass, listening to the drums in your case, listening to the sax, playing piano, comping, doing all that. So now you're singing. So basically you had to relearn that whole thing while you're, wow.
Right.
Seems like a lot of work.
Well, but
I'm not saying it's not a bad thing.
Almost like a meditative exercise in a way, and you know, I could go down that rabbit hole for a whole other interview. But yeah, I think, you know, to be able to, you know, I'm kind of a fan of that. I take bits of it and I don't like bits of it, but that book Effortless Mastery, that Kenny Werner book Effortless Mastery, where he almost has you at a certain point, he has you practicing, where you're almost watching your hands like someone else is playing them while you kind of sit there and just sort of watch, like almost as a detached observer. And I've started to do the same thing with singing, where I kind of, and that's one way you can kind of try to hear what it sounds like in the context of the group, because you step back for a second and you're not 100% so absorbed with what's going on. You can actually, you know, hear it in relation to the rest of the group. So
yeah.
I don't know. I'm big on these kind of little meditative tricks, but
I think that a lot of music, right? I mean, when you really get to a level where you're at, a lot of music, you don't have to sit and learn, you know, giant steps changes all afternoon. I mean, but I think it's pulling back and getting conceptually what's happening in your mind and understanding what it is, and that's the only way that you can continue to expand your improvisation and your ability to play, right? I mean, it's because you get to a point at your level with all the different things you have going on. I mean, you could probably just, you know, do whatever you're doing for the next 20 years and you wouldn't be happy probably, but, you know, it would sound okay.
Yeah.
But taking it to the next level. And you're constantly recording too now, right? I mean, you just put out the Christmas thing this past...
That's coming out next week, I think.
Yeah, or the past month since we're in January.
Oh, right, January.
But, I mean, you've got 6 other releases out, I think I read, right?
That sounds about right. If I can remember, yeah.
So, and you're on other people's recordings too. So I think that it's... You tell me, but it seems like you're somebody that just wants to keep trying to push forward as an artist.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always trying to improve whatever I can, whatever aspect I can. And these days it's mostly been working on singing, but of course I've been on a whole Barry Harris kick this week where I've been trying to sort of check out some of his ideas and incorporate them. So I'm always looking for new things to add. That's another thing about New York. It keeps you on your toes. There's so many good players that, you know, if there's always somebody, you know, the person who comes in and sits on your gig, you're like, man, he could play the gig just fine, you know, or she could play the gig just fine. So yeah, that keeps you on your toes a bit. But I think even without that, I'm always just trying to improve. And the records are, you know, I think that's just the thing. You know, CDs and LPs and stuff, who knows sort of what the future of that is. But and when I tour, especially in Europe and in Asia, I still find people that want those physical CDs. So I make them partly for that. And then, you know, they're just, each one is a challenge, and it's an excuse to see how good of a record I can make and try out different bands and rhythm sections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we could talk for 2 hours about the marketing aspect of right. everything else. That's a whole other thing. But I think that the recording aspect for somebody that is performing a lot and doing a lot of stuff, it's like you're documenting that mm-hmm. part of your life.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's why
Absolutely.
It's important to do at least recordings, even if it's just digitally there and it's streaming.
Right.
You know, you always want to do that. So you have a lot of gigs coming up in January, February, March. You know, we talked a little bit. You're going to be, why don't you talk a little bit about, so you're going to be at Steinway?
Yeah, so I got that distinction as a Steinway artist yeah. recently. And so they're going to include me at as part of a monthly concert series they do at their sort of flagship showroom in Midtown Manhattan.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And they have their showroom, and then in the downstairs they have a beautiful concert hall. It's pretty small, holds about 75 people. But they have, of course, an amazing piano there, yeah. and the acoustics are great. So I'm going to do January 21st, I'm doing a trio show down there. And then the Monday after, I think it's the 28th.
27th.
Yep. Thank you. I'll be at Birdland with a quartet. So it'll be me and my trio and then this amazing sax player, Jerry Weldon, who's one of the best.
Yeah. And he comes to Chicago like once in a great while.
Yeah, I think he's coming next month, he said, with Dave Schumacher right. to do their thing at the Mill.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun. And that's actually in the Birdland Theater, which is it's their new venue, which is in their basement.
Oh,
so man. Birdland opened up a second club in their own basement. But I've heard that it's great. I think they're both doing very well, and I've heard that the new spot is a really a nice spot to play.
Oh, that's dynamite. And then you're going to Switzerland, February 11th to 15th.
I'll be in Switzerland. There's a great club in Bern called Marianne's Jazz Room,
mm-hmm.
and they've been around for a long time. And it's a beautiful spot. It's kind of an old school gig where you stay in the hotel, and then the club is in the basement of the hotel, and you play there five nights in a row, two sets a night, and you get to basically just live and eat in this beautiful hotel, and you go downstairs for your gig every night. I mean, it could be worse. You know,
it's like the old Blackstone Hotel with the Jazz yeah. Showcase when that was in there, and everybody would stay in the hotel and then play and then stay. Yeah, cool too, because what are the crowds like in Switzerland or in Europe and stuff? I mean, they like to hang probably, right, and meet the artists and like
yeah.
they're respectful, I think too.
They are very respectful. There's some really great fans there. I mean, last time I played at Marianne's, it's in Bern, but I had a couple fans who lived in Vienna who came all the way, and that's like a six-hour, eight-hour drive
wow.
or something, and they came to, you know, to check it out. So they have some great fans there. The audiences in Europe tend to be a little more on the older side, especially if you're playing straight-ahead jazz. They tend to be, you know, 50s minimum
yeah.
and more
yeah.
often 60s and 70s, so they tend to be older. But they know the music super well. They've been listening to American jazz artists going over there for the last 40 years and have really seen a lot of the greats. And they buy CDs, which is also nice. So they're good jazz fans to play for.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on all your success here. I'm glad you got to come back to Chicago. We got to sit down and talk
yeah.
a little bit.
Coming back here. I come back at least, you know, usually 3 or 4 times a year and do a few gigs and see a bunch of friends. And every time I come back, I remember why I stayed here so long.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so benpatterson.com is a good
website. That's right.
Good
one
website.
One T, Patterson.
Ben Patterson, one yep. T, yes. And we'll link everything up below. Ben, thanks so much, man. I appreciate you sitting down.
My pleasure.
And thanks so much for watching. This is Ben, the January 2020 feature interview. And, of course, you can get more information and see the entire issue at ChicagoJazzMagazine.com. All of our back issues for the past couple of years are up there as well. And of course, if you want daily podcasts, videos, and all that other good stuff, ChicagoJazz.com is where we have all of that. So until next month, we'll see you somewhere out on the scene.